Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, occasionally on American Variety, we have a show that's part of a series I call Old Florida Days, in recognition of American Variety's beginnings on various Florida stations. And this is one of those shows. My guest is the author of several books set in Florida, and in particular, two of them that tell the story of a Florida cattle ranching family spanning over 100 years, from the start of the 20th century to the early 21st century. He's recently written a third novel that focuses on the story of someone who's an incidental character from one of the previous books. It's called I Mean You No Harm. The author is William Collier Hall, and the three books together form a trilogy that he calls the Kissimmee Valley Trilogy. They all take place mainly in central Florida, from Kissimmee, south of Orlando, over to the East Coast and down to Lake Okeechobee and the towns and swamps around the lake, and they range from the late 1890s up to the early 2000s. So Bill Hall is my guest today. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Court. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you being on. And this is the second time Bill's been on the show. The first time was a couple of years back. We were talking about the first two books, and those two books tell the story of the Rawlerson ranching family. And they were actually written in reverse chronological order. The first one, published of the two, called The Trouble with Panthers, takes place chronologically after the second one, called Florida Boy. So Florida Boy is actually a prequel to The Trouble with Panthers. And now Bill's published a book called a novel called I Mean You No Harm, which sits chronologically in the middle of the first two. So now that I've probably confused most of our listeners, let me ask you, Bill, to give us a quick overview of the stories of the first two books and where the character of the newest book fits in.
Okay, The Trouble with Panthers, which was the first, spans from 2004 to midway in 2005. So it's not exactly a historical novel, but a lot of text and dialogue comes up in the story that allowed the Historical Society to want to publish it. It pretty much describes the end of the Rawlerson family and this 8,000-acre ranch that they own on the shores of Lake Kissimmee. Then Florida Boy, the second book of the trilogy, begins, as Court said, around 1898, when a fellow named John Morgan Rawlerson is born. And then it goes all the way up to about 1918. And the third book, I Mean You No Harm, begins in 1928 and goes to 2004.
Okay, so Nakne, N-A-K-N-E, as the man with no name who's in I Mean You No Harm, and he's a Miccosukee Indian who is given no name, was given no name by his father and treated almost as a pariah from birth. And this is described in the beginning of your latest novel, I Mean You No Harm. So why was that? Why was he not given a name?
Well, Nakne is the word man in the Miccosukee or Hitchity language. His mother, while giving birth to him, passes away. And she is the last female of the Wolf Clan. Therefore, and in the Miccosukee and the Muscogee or Seminole tribes, they're a maternal order. The woman passes on the lineage. And since his mother died and she had no sisters, he is, this boy with no name, is the last of the Wolf Clan. Therefore, his father does not name him. Now, later in the story, he encounters a brother, another Miccosukee, during his travels, and this man refers to him as Nakne, or man.
So he's kind of, he's the end of, it's a matrilineal society, as you said, and so he's the end of the line, and because he's a male, there's no point in giving him a name, so he's kind of a lost kid wandering in the wilderness from the start. But as you mentioned, Bill, he's Miccosukee as opposed to Seminole. So just briefly, what's the difference for our listeners who probably the majority of people don't know that distinction? So what is the difference, and are they two separate tribes?
Well, the Seminoles generally came out of the Upper Creek Nation, which migrated to Florida because of the white pressures, and they also were at war with the lower creeks, which the Miccosukees are derived from. The Miccosukees actually came to Florida around the year 1750. They first settled in the neighborhood of what is now Tallahassee, but got pushed further south and ultimately wound up below the Caloosahatchee River down into the Everglades. Our Pika, or Sam Jones as we called him, was the major Miccosukee chief in that area. But the Seminoles spoke Muscogee, which is the Upper Creek language, and the Miccosukees spoke Hitchity, which is, of course, their language. But the words, if you take the trouble to look them up, they're very similar. They did not have trouble communicating with one another.
So it sounds like they're technically different tribes, but kind of first cousins. I mean, closely related tribes, sub-tribes of the Creeks in a way, I guess.
And yes, at one time they were mortal enemies.
Oh, yeah.
Before they came to Florida, it's the enemy of my enemy can be my friend.
So I think the Miccosukees lived more, south of Lake Okeechobee and south of what's now Tamiami Trail. I mean, in the really southern part of the Everglades, and the Seminoles lived further north up into North Florida as well. So when we first encounter Nakni in your book, as you said, it's 1928, and he's just emerged out of the Everglades, south of the Tamiami Trail, and he's a tall, arresting-looking young man, really striking-looking guy of about 20 years old, and everyone who meets him, even other Indians, seems stunned by his appearance and general demeanor. So why is that? Why are they all so, basically like, whoa, when they looked at him?
He has lived up to this point on a small island below the Big Cypress. He speaks English due to the fact that a Jesuit sister came to live with him for almost a year and taught him primarily from the Bible.
But I mean, I think it's the way that he looks, because he looks like a throwback, kind of atavistic. I mean, he says, I mean you no harm to people, to disarm them, because they seem often, or most of the time, to be either alarmed or surprised or astonished at his appearance, because he looks like somebody from 100 years ago, right?
Yes. Yes, he still dresses in the traditional dress, which is a long shirt that formerly belonged to his father. And it was upon the death of his grandfather and then his father that prompted him to head north and see the outside world. He journeys northward, basically in search of his purpose. He has a great-grandfather that he knows is buried in a hammock on the eastern shore of Lake Kissimmee. And this is how it ties in with the Rollerson family. Of course, the Rollersons own that hammock. It's part of their 8,000-acre ranch. Nakni is going to travel to that grave to try and spiritually commune with his great-grandfather. He desires, and this was put into his mind by his grandfather, he desires to be a holy man. Hilas Hajo is the Miccosukee term for it. And in 1928, this, of course, as Court said, this is when the journey begins, August of 1928 to be exact, during which a major hurricane hits South Florida, and Nakni survives that hurricane by huddling in a hollow tree, and then 1 month later, he's hit with a second hurricane that kills many people on the shores of Lake Okeechobee.
And that's actually true. I mean, that's a historical fact, yeah.
Yeah, the one in August and the one in September. Now, during this journey, Nakni meets people along the way, and eventually he will meet a young Rollerson named July, who in the original book, The Trouble with Panthers, July is the patriarch. And at that time, he's, in an advanced age. But when Nakni meets July, July is an 11-year-old, just a kid, and they become very good friends. And then, of course, in the trouble with panthers, July's grandson, whose name is Bodhi, will meet Nakni as well. And Nakni is a very old man at that time.
Yeah, he lives, I guess to be almost 100, so his life kind of spans several generations of the Rawlersons, and some of them are closer to him than others, but he lives on their land when he comes north. But, you know, he's very peripatetic. I mean, you know, but let's get back to a couple things. I mean, you mentioned that he's spiritual, and he'd gone to visit his great-grandfather's grave, which was the first time that he left his ancestral home and went north, you know, walking hundreds of miles barefoot. And he is kind of spiritual, and he's read the Bible. As you mentioned, he had been taught by a Jesuit, I guess, a teacher. But a recurring theme in the book is his belief in King Solomon's prophecy that what has been will be again. And so Nakni thinks that that means that the way his people lived in the past will return, maybe even after he's long gone. So it seems oddly naive, even for someone as innocent as he is. But did you mean it as a warning of some kind of post-apocalyptic future where we'll all be reduced back to living in a primitive way like his ancestors did? Or did I read too much into that?
Maybe a little too much. The book of the Bible that he is most enthralled with is Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon. And his grandfather had related to him that during his youth, a prophet came among the Miccosukees and the Seminoles, and that was his philosophy as well, that what has been will be again. And this was to prompt them to go to continue to fight the foreigners or the white people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he reads Ecclesiastes, he thinks that maybe the prophet and Solomon were one and the same. And he wants to believe that the old way will come again. But, of course, as he ages and goes through, walks through life, he comes to the realization that he's not going to see it, if it, in fact, ever does happen.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author William Collier Hall about the most recent of his three novels that he's written, centered, taking place in Central Florida. This one's called I Mean You No Harm, and it's the last of what he calls the Kissimmee Valley Trilogy, talking about, you know, a ranching family that spans over a century. And then this particular book, I Mean You No Harm, is about an Indian, a Miccosukee Indian, who whose life is kind of entangled with theirs. And in the other first two books, he's kind of a minor character, but this book is about him. And so, you know, we talked about earlier, Bill, about other Indians that he meets, even very elderly ones seem kind of envious and maybe even a little afraid of him because they've never met another one who's not, in quotes here, gone in, which is, the phrase that they used, which means like co-opted by white America and made to live on the reservation and that kind of thing. So can you describe the sort of the system of inducements for Seminoles and Miccosukees that went on, I guess, in the early part of the 20th century in particular to live on the reservation and become, quote, civilized and, you know, controlled?
Yeah, they were actually offered reward if they would come in and live on the various reservations around Lake Okeechobee and on the Tamiami Trail so that they could be recorded on the foreigners' lists, and the foreigners could keep track of them. And I say foreigner, that's the way he views us, the people who have come to push them out.
Mm-hmm.
And the indigenous people that he meets along the way, they've all gone in. They wear blue jeans and our clothes, our hats.
Mm-hmm.
Most have cut their hair. And they're shocked to see someone that they've only been told about, a person that looks like he stepped out, like you said, from the last century.
Yeah, he's
it's not that they fear him. They actually envy him. I think one of the Seminoles that he meets says, "You still have ears."
Yeah, I think they're ashamed that they've basically been beaten, you know, and forced to surrender and come in, and they find one who's still a holdout, and he's very impressive to them. In the real world, Bill, do you know if there are any of his original clan left who haven't, or any Miccosukees at all, who haven't gone in, even a little bit, left out in the far hammocks of South Florida and the Everglades? Are there any at all like that?
Well, I knew a traditional Seminole, Bobby Billy. Mm-hmm. He's since passed away. I don't know exactly how many people he had in his group, but they lived on 700 acres north of Okeechobee near Fort Drum. They refused the monies from the casinos, and they tried to live in the traditional sense. They did have some of the modern, because I know Bobby had a pickup. He didn't use it all the time, but he did have one.
Mm-hmm.
He could not read or write. But he passed away approximately 3 or 4 years ago. I can't remember the exact date.
Hmm.
But, yeah, I met him several times, and he was a very interesting character.
I'll bet. I mean, back when I was, 16 maybe or so, about 1966, maybe I hunted at that time, and I was out by myself hunting west of Fort Pierce, Florida, where I lived at the time, which is Central Florida. And kind of in the zone where your trilogy is occurring too, and so I'd walked several miles out west of Fort Pierce from some road west of there, and I came up on a little encampment, a family basically encampment of Seminole people living in a chickie or a couple of chickies, the kind of straw thatched huts, the bamboo frond thatched huts that they lived in, and they lived in a pretty traditional way. I mean, they had some modern things, and they were a little wary of me, and I just basically, but they could, some of them at least could speak English and well enough. And I said, I'm tired. Do you mind? I've walked a long way. Do you mind if I sit on this log over here and rest? And really what I wanted to do was just going to watch them for a while and see what they were like, because I was a kid, they just kind of humored me and let me sit there for a couple hours. But that was interesting. And they, just watching them go about their business. And it was, like primitive life, kind of boring in a way, and but they were happy enough, and it was interesting to watch, but I don't know, I doubt they're there anymore. But I mean, so Nakhni is completely self-reliant. I mean, his possessions are, he's just by himself, and he has a blanket and a water gourd and a cooking pot and a little .22 rifle, just like the one I had in the time I described just then, and a few simple implements and the clothes on his back, and that's it. He's basically got what amounts to a homemade backpack kind of thing. And as I said before, he goes barefoot and he walks hundreds of miles. So he's very peripatetic, going from place to place and avoiding contact with, as you say, the foreigners, and even avoiding other Indians for the most part. And so, I was going to say, in the early years of the story, that seems plausible, since these areas weren't very heavily populated back in the early, part of the 20th century, but toward the end of the book, into the 21st century, it gets harder and harder to do that, right? So he moves mainly at night and tries to be invisible. And you think that it'd even still be possible to do today, to walk miles and miles through Florida without ever encountering another person, even if you were very secretive about it?
I believe so. Mm-hmm. We still have panthers.
Yeah, a few.
And
yep.
They are pretty much invisible. And we've even had panthers. I live in Brevard County, which is even further north than Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had panthers and bears here, and they pretty much stay invisible. Most people don't believe they're here, but they are.
Mm-hmm.
And Nakhni, he moved like the panther. Mm-hmm. And toward the later in the book, around 1970, he stumbles upon the development of Walt Disney World.
Right.
And which is a tremendous shock to him.
Mm-hmm.
And an old cattleman explains to him what's going on. And, of course, that just further depresses him.
Yeah, because he's so attuned to the land and to nature. And it's basically bulldozers tearing up thousands of acres and turning it into dirt, which is going to be then turned into, you know, the Magic Kingdom, and it he almost has post-traumatic shock from it. But we're not going to talk about what he does there because that would be a little anticlimactic, and we want people to buy the book and read it. You know, one thing about Nakhni, Bill, is that he seems to have a very simple, insightful wisdom, you know, even with his limited experience of the world, and several times gives advice to people he encounters that impacts their lives. And probably it's because he's so simple and so innocent, right? But did you mean for him to come across as almost like a wandering Christ-like figure? Because that's kind of how it seemed to me.
No, that was not intentional. Nakhni, being of the Wolf Clan, something we haven't mentioned thus far, he has a companion for almost 10 years that is the offspring of a red wolf, which in 1929 is when he gets this pup from July Rollerson, who the red wolf bred one of their dogs, and she had pups, and they look like wolves.
Right.
And Nakhni says he is not a wolf, he is but a memory of wolves. Because as he is, you know, his clan is ending. 1929 was the last documented red wolf in Florida. And I tried to use that as a metaphor, just a way of life coming to an end.
Mm-hmm. Well, each chapter begins with a short teaching by Nakhni's grandfather to him. And, you know, these are presented as things that he remembers his grandfather saying. And, you know, to me, they all seem very authentic. Did you invent them entirely or get them some from your friend Billy that you mentioned earlier?
No, they just came to me. I keep the painting of the cover of this book, which is a painting done by James Hutchison of Halpatter Tustenuggee Alligator, which people don't seem to know whether he was Miccosukee or Seminole, but a lot of people think that he was Miccosukee. I have that painting over my office desk, and he's been a muse for me for over 30 years. I don't know if he gave me those statements or what, but the grandfather, I wanted him to come across as being a wise man, and it just came to me out of the ether. That's all I can say.
Wow. Well, they really do seem, you know, I mean, I read a lot. They seem pretty convincing to me as being authentic things that an American Indian elder might say, you know. So, you know, well, I wanted to ask you, what was it like writing these three books out of chronological sequence, which is not normally the way it's done? I mean, you wrote the third book first and the first book second and the middle book that's kind of in between them all third. So what, was it hard to keep track of who did what when you're writing the book? You know, as far as the chronology, that you're sandwiching this book in between the first two, right? So was it hard to keep track of that?
After writing The Trouble with Panthers, the modern-day version of the Rollerson family, dialogue and happenings in that first book pretty much dictated the second book, which was the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
How they came to have the 8,000 acres and all the people who died and the events that had to take place in order to get me to 2004. And then the middle book, something I had not mentioned at this point, the Nakhni does appear in Florida Boy in the year 1918.
Mm-hmm.
He's a small child with his grandfather at the grave on the Rollerson Ranch.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Of course, he appears before John Morgan Rollerson, who, you know, he doesn't know who he is. He just thinks they've come to visit their ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, of course, at 2004, when Bodie Rollerson meets him, old July tells him, he said, you listen to what that old man says. You can learn a lot from him.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls him Solomon because
he's
always referring to Ecclesiastes.
Well, you know, both your books and your background, Bill, and I know something of that from having talked to you, they remind me of the famed Florida author Patrick Smith, best known for a novel, the novel A Land Remembered, which takes place in a similar setting with similar people. And Patrick Smith was a guest on American Variety in our early days of the show. And I'd say your books are written every bit as well as his. I mean, they're good books. And you both seem to have nostalgia for a time long past, and a rural and pastoral Eden before technology overtook our lives. And in your case, what comes across is an admiration, I think, for the pre-European Indian worldview of, you know, as we mentioned, being attuned to nature and man's place in it and in balance with it. And so, you know, I've been guessing wrong so far about the higher meanings of the book that I'm reading into it, but would you say that's kind of a background basic philosophy of the book?
Yes, I think you hit it right on the head. When I was a young boy, I grew up in the woods, pretty much.
Yeah.
I hate to admit it, but I rarely wore shoes until about the third grade.
Mm-hmm.
When we were forced to. But fishing and hunting, those were the things that I loved to do, and I was pretty naive myself. But yes, I admired the Native Americans.
Yeah, so, you know, you're Florida, like mine to a great extent. I mean, I'm roughly your age, and I'm a third generation Miamian, and so we both remember A Land Remembered of Florida. Many waves of immigrants ago. I mean, immigrants from other parts of the U.S. mainly, and you know. So it was a different world back then for sure. You know, I remember when Miami was basically a big small southern town, pretty much. Well, Bill, we just have a minute or so left, but let me ask you just quickly if you can answer briefly, what's next for you as a writer?
I haven't figured that out yet. I've got some ideas. I'm coming to the point where I think I'm going to have more time to write, and so I'm definitely going to continue. I just haven't selected the topic.
Do you think it'll still be about old-time Florida? Old Florida
Oh, yes.
Days?
Yes, absolutely. My primary reason for doing this is I want to leave something for my sons.
Okay, well, good. We've been talking with William Collier Hall, and all three of his novels were published by the Florida Historical Society Press. The Trouble with Panthers, the first book in the trilogy, was published in 2010, and it won the Gold Medal for Popular Fiction of the Florida Humanities Council in 2011. So, as I say, these are well-written books. You know, they're not amateur efforts at all. And they're available at myfloridahistory.org. So that's all one word, myfloridahistory.org. And you go to the FHS tab, and you can see the books that are there for sale by the Florida Historical Society Press, and you can buy any of these three books or all three of these books online. Well, Bill, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been interesting.
Thank you, Court. I enjoyed being here.
Thanks to all of you for listening, too. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.